Good afternoon. May it please the court. The issue in this case is whether trial counsel was ineffective for failing to request a level of liability instruction based upon the aggravating factor attached to making the attempted robbery first degree. This court in its direct appeal decision recognized that there was a factual basis for the level of liability instruction.
Could I interrupt you right there? Could you tell us, notwithstanding what this court said, what the factual basis for a lesser, the level of liability instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. The level, the factual basis would have been the testimony of Oscar Johnson, who testified at trial that Mr. Dickinson did not know that they were intending upon committing a robbery. And during the trial, the state then played the statement under 3507, which contradicted that. But there was testimony by Oscar Johnson exculpating Mr. Dickinson. I think the original statement to the police by Mr. Thomas did not indicate that Mr. Dickinson was involved. I don't think he mentioned that. And then there's circumstantial evidence about whether or not Mr. Dickinson knew that as Johnson and Thomas exited the car, whether he observed them possessing a weapon. So that is the general basis for that.
Thank you.
And I'm correct to assume from at least the review of the record sent to us that the trial judge did not charge on any lesser included offenses?
He did not.
Not a 274, but just no,
yeah, no lesser included offenses. And I'm not aware if that was discussed in a prayer conference or not. I know that the lesser, or the Section 274 was not discussed at all. Whether or not lesser included offenses were discussed, I'm not sure. But I'm sure if it was discussed that trial counsel would have maintained that it was inconsistent with his all or nothing strategy. But lesser included offense, they're similar to the level of liability instruction, but they're not the functional equivalent.
No, I understand that. I just wanted to know whether the jury had any conception of lesser included offenses, or the jury assumed this trial was tried as charged from the beginning to the end.
That's correct, and that's what the concern is, because there were no level of liability instruction or lesser included instruction, the jury was left with the greater charge, attempted robbery first degree, and they didn't have a full understanding of what the law is as it pertained to Mr. Dickinson, and therefore they were left with, we have some evidence of a crime, many of the elements may have been satisfied but not all, so we have a choice, convict or let them go. And I think that's tough for a jury to do under these circumstances.
Did he either admit or concede to the jury that he believed they were on a drug run?
He didn't testify, and there was no testimony from Mr. Dickinson.
Was there any testimony that he believed they were on a drug run from anyone, but did not
Yes.
know they were going to commit a robbery?
Johnson, I think, originally said it was for drugs. When he testified, it was to meet up with girls. He denied that it was drugs. But I think his 3507 statement related to going there for it was drug related.
Okay.
So the law of the case, as I read it, is that there was a factual predicate for that instruction. In the direct appeal, the court made a decision, there was a strategic decision. We now know to reject the level of liability. We now know, based upon trial counsel's affidavit, that he wasn't even aware of the Allen decision. So there was not a conscious.
But was he aware of Section 274?
Well, he should have been, and if he was, it was not an issue that he raised. The factual predicate, even though Allen was decided shortly before this trial, the factual predicate for requesting the instruction has always been there. And I think when the trial counsel states that he wasn't aware of the Allen decision, he never qualified and said, even though I wasn't aware of that decision, I am aware of Section 274. If he was aware of it, he never brought it up.
Okay, well, people can shape their affidavit any way they want to.
Yes.
We know that from experience.
Correct.
The Allen decision was relatively new. 274 is not relatively new.
That's correct.
But he didn't make an unequivocal statement one way or another about knowledge that an instruction on liability of accomplices was available.
He never expressed the legal predicate for making for requesting the level of liability instruction. He never mentioned 274 in his affidavit. He never said, you know, I'm aware of Section 274. I'm not aware of the Allen decision. He just said that I wasn't aware of the Allen decision.
Right, I understand it. And I'm trying to get straight in my own mind whether that's a carefully worded affidavit, whether it's conveniently left out that he was aware of 274, or whether there's some legitimate argument to be made that in the face of his client's demand that he be tried on an all-or-nothing basis, if you're not aware of the Allen decision, why would you even think of the limited liability decision?
Well,
the limited level.
I can't speculate on to what trial counsel's level of knowledge is. He's a seasoned trial attorney. I have great respect for him. So I can't speculate on that. But when he says he wasn't aware of Allen without any qualification, I think it's reasonably to infer that he didn't consider, not only he wasn't aware of Allen, but he didn't consider Section, yeah. Wasn't aware of the...
Well, I'm trying to get in straight my mind why he would not have thought of 274. He had to know it existed because, as you point out, he is a seasoned criminal defense lawyer and his practice is basically exclusively criminal defense or close to it.
Right.
He had to be thinking about 274, no matter what his affidavit says. He had to at least be aware of it. But in the face of his client's preferred option, why would he seriously think of it and submit, by way of example, a proposed instruction on it?
Well, if it were me, and knowing the existence of 274 and what's at stake here, the possibly avoiding a mandatory life sentence,
right.
That's something that I would bring up in a prayer conference, put on the record that there's a predicate for this, and that I've spoken to my client about it, and we've decided not to pursue it. To not even raise it at all, at any time in these proceedings, to me reflects a lack of knowledge of it.
Well, the other side of that coin is, if you bring it up, as you described it in the prayer conference, to cover the record for yourself, if not for your client, you're basically tempting the trial judge to say, oh, there is a factual predicate for it, but you're not asking for it. It's the law. I'm going to give it anyway. And where has he left his client under those circumstances?
Well, I think this court has already decided that that's within the realm of lawyer autonomy to decide whether or not it's like a lesser included offense. They're going to leave it up to the attorney to decide as a matter of strategy whether or not they want to pursue it. This court has already issued a decision that if nobody requests it, the court can't sua sponte issue in fact, it was this case that was the issue on direct appeal. Nobody requested it. Did the court have a duty to give that instruction, and this court said, no, there's no duty when there's no request.
Well, we conveniently have cases that say the opposite as well, depending on the fact situation.
Yes,
couched in terms of the trial judge is assumed to know the law, and where an instruction is needed to assist the jury in understanding the law, requested or not, the trial judge has an obligation to give it.
Yes. I think it's reasonably to infer that this never entered the defense attorney's mind. I don't think he would have been that crafty to not raise it in order for the judge not to consider giving it on his own.
Okay, well, tell us about the application of the facts here to the standard we have to apply in reviewing his conduct.
Well, under Strickland, there's the decision on whether his strategy was objective, his performance was objectively unreasonable. And I think we've demonstrated that by the fact that he didn't demonstrate any knowledge of the existing law that could have benefited Mr. Dickinson. And a lawyer is charged with understanding the law. And even if he wasn't going to pursue that option, I think he had to, as this court has stated under Cook, you have a continuing obligation to keep your client informed. And one of the options was the level of liability instruction. And I think it's incumbent upon a counsel to at least express that this exists, this is an option, and this is a potential way to avoid the mandatory life sentence under 4214B.
All right, but the second prong of Strickland goes to colloquialize it. Would it have made any difference at the end of the day anyway? It would have been inconsistent with what his client's expectations and desires were in terms of the way the trial would be handled.
Well, he's
already rejected two plea offers that would have gotten the same result that you're arguing for now.
But he still needs to be made aware of this option because especially criminal trials are fluid. I always tell clients it's like a football game. You have a strategy. There's going to be fumbles and interceptions. And at any time during a trial, if things are turning south, you turn to your client and say, do you still want to maintain this? Do you want to, at the end of this, when you look at the evidence and, you know, you had this good plan, but it didn't pan out, you still have time to say, you know, we can minimize our damage. We can pursue this level of liability. We can try to avoid the mandatory life sentence that looks like it's coming down.
Let me just follow up my last question, and I'll turn it over to someone else. But I want to make sure I understand this response. Do you agree with me that if the level of liability charge had been given, the best result would have been the same as the plea he had rejected twice?
If he had they had given the level of liability and he was found guilty of the second-degree robbery and second-degree burglary, he would have been facing similar time.
As with the plea offers?
Yes. Okay. But, again, that was at the beginning of the trial when you don't know what the co-defendants are going to testify to and, you know, whether they're going to remain faithful to you or not.
Did they all have 3507 statements?
I'm aware of, I don't think Thomas had a statement inculpating Dickinson. I think it was after his plea he decided to support the state. Johnson had the 3507 statement that was played, but at trial he testified in favor of Dickinson, so they kind of reversed.
What is the evidence that under Strickland, the second part, that your client was prejudiced?
The prejudice was he wasn't aware of an option that could have been implemented to avoid the mandatory life sentence
well,
on 4214.
It would only avoid the mandatory life sentence if he got a different result from the jury, right?
Correct.
And what is the showing that there's a reasonable probability that would have happened?
Well, I think the test is whether it undermines the confidence in the result. And We don't know because he never had that opportunity. He didn't consider it. It's
Wait a second. The prejudice element of Strickland, what you're saying is you never satisfy that one because we don't know what would have happened.
Well,
that's not what the law is it?
No, this is the prejudice. The prejudice was the jury was misled about a very significant aspect of the law as it relates to individual culpability for an aggravating factor.
But don't we still have to make a determination as to whether, if we assume hypothetically that the jury was given all of this information about the law, would the result have been different?
Well, in all these cases, it's speculation. All I can suggest is that the jury didn't operate under a full understanding of the law as it pertains to Mr. Dickinson's culpability for the higher degree.
Wasn't there pretty overwhelming evidence of his culpability at the higher degree?
There was evidence that an attempted robbery first degree occurred. His involvement in that, his level of involvement, is what was at issue.
Right.
And the jury could have been led to understand that, well, the crime occurred. We're advising you on the law of accomplice liability, that if you assist the two people who are involved in that, then you're guilty too, which is partly true, but it's not completely true, because if the jury doesn't understand, if he didn't understand that these two guys were carrying a weapon.
Well, wait a second. Wasn't it his weapon?
There was evidence that it was in his car, that there was ammunition in his car. There is no evidence that I recall that it was his weapon.
Did you want to save the balance of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Maria Knoll, representing the State of Delaware. Joseph Dickinson's convictions and sentence are not the result of ineffective assistance of counsel. He had competent, experienced counsel who made strategic, reasonable decisions based upon the facts of the case and consistent with what the defendant wanted presented at trial. This was an all-or-nothing defense. That is what the defendant wanted. That is what was presented in this case. And as the defense attorney put in his affidavit, although he was not aware specifically of the Allen decision, he was aware of lesser-included offenses, did not ask for them, and would have not wanted to ask for level of liability instructions either, because that would have diluted the main defense, the chosen defense, of all or nothing.
The argument that we're confronted with, though, is that at some point during the trial, it should have been evident or become evident to defense counsel that that strategy was going south. The argument goes, under Strickland, he had a professional obligation to basically ask his client once again in mid-trial whether the client wanted to reconsider this all-or-nothing strategy.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that Strickland says that you have to turn to your client mid-trial and ask if you want to change your strategy. Perhaps if it was obvious that things were going south, as Mr. Modica indicates, but the state would say that it was obvious things were going south when the verdicts came. That was when it was obvious that the all-or-nothing defense wasn't going to work. At the beginning,
Are you saying it wasn't obvious until the jury came down with the verdict?
Yes, Your Honor. In opening statements, the defense attorney indicated to the jury, both of these co-defendants are going to come in here, and both of them are going to tell you that Mr. Dickinson was complicit, was a co-defendant, and was actively involved in this robbery. That's not what happened at trial. One defendant came in and said Mr. Dickinson didn't know anything. And when he dropped us off, we told him we were doing a robbery, and he said, get out of my car. So the first one contradicted his prior statement. The second one came in and said, gave up Mr. Dickinson, but the defense attorney was able to establish that that was only after he received a very beneficial plea. His 3507 statement didn't implicate the defendant.
So maybe the trial was going north, not south. Huh?
Well, it seems to me that the evidence that the defense attorney and the defendant thought was going to come in, which was both defendants giving him up at trial, didn't actually happen. So it's reasonable to think that this all-or-nothing defense, in his mind, was going to work. And no reason for him to turn around at that point and say, oh, it's definitely going south. It became obvious it was going south when it did.
Let's assume, perhaps counterfactually, that there was some point where a reasonable defense attorney would have concluded that the direction was heading south. Is there any case law in the Strickland jurisprudence that basically says that at that point there is a professional obligation on defense counsel's part to do a mid-course correction or a mid-course second look?
I am not aware of any cases that say that, Your Honor. I am just aware of what the Strickland standard is, which was whether the defense attorney's actions fell below a level of objective reasonableness and whether that caused the defendant prejudice.
So, are you saying that you've looked but haven't found those cases?
I actually did look, Your Honor, yes, but I'm just saying that I didn't find them. I'm not saying they're not out there.
Yeah.
In this case, it was quite clear when the defendant decided that he did not want to take the plea on two different occasions, which was going to be probably a better result than anything that could have happened at trial short of acquittal, that an all-or-nothing defense was what they were looking at. And the defense attorney, to the best of his ability, effected that all-or-nothing defense on the behalf of the defendant. The fact that it did not work out does not mean it was ineffective assistance of counsel.
What about prejudice? Assuming we were to find that it was ineffective assistance of counsel.
There's no prejudice here, Your Honor. I don't believe that there's cause to say that the result of this case would have been any different. The issue between attempted robbery first and attempted robbery second was the gun. The evidence in this case showed that the gun was in the defendant's car in a very large red pool cue case, that there was ammunition also found in his car, and that he had also said, you can search my house, and they found the same type of red-colored ammunition in his shaving bag at his home. So I don't think it's reasonable to assume that he would have been found guilty of anything other than the attempted robbery first and the related charges. The court has nothing further. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, with respect to whether counsel has ongoing duty during the course of the trial, I think the Cook opinion addresses that, because the Cook opinion, where this court provided that the defendant can represent himself, went through in detail counsel's duty, and it speaks of an ongoing duty to keep the client informed about law and facts. And I suggest that it includes strategy. So I think there's an ongoing duty, and I think it's...
Based on what, besides intuition?
The duty to continue to advise the client throughout the trial. I mean, I think that's just good trial work. Hey, client...
That wasn't the question.
Okay.
There's a strategy that's been settled on. It's been underscored with big, bright yellow lines twice by the client rejecting two favorable plea offers. The only thing that's happened now is that there is there is a new development in the case law, but it doesn't to take advantage of that would be contrary to the strategy. So the narrow question, not the question of whether there's an ongoing duty to continue to advise the client, but whether there's an ongoing duty to question or re-question the strategy.
Well, first of all, the initial strategy was not informed because it wasn't based with the full understanding of legal options. So it was not an informed strategy. It was a strategy, but it was not based upon existing legal options for that client. Now, in terms of during the course of the trial, the duty to steer away from the initial strategy, all I can suggest is that
Did you make the argument that the initial strategic decision and the decision of the client to adhere to them was not informed?
Yes, because I stated the client was never advised as to his options for the level of liability instruction. I mean, that was a key part of my my argument, that since the attorney wasn't aware of Allen and possibly 274, he didn't express to the client his options and his rights under that. Well, therefore, it's not an informed strategy.
I understand your time is up, but he did understand, didn't he, that he had the option of an all-or-nothing defense or lesser-included offenses, even if they weren't couched in terms of Section 274, and he rejected that. What is the fundamental difference between presenting to the jury, my guy's an accomplice, you can consider his state of mind, which is different than that of those who committed attempted first-degree robbery. At most, his state of mind could be considered to be consistent with attempted second-degree robbery. How is that not just as inconsistent as lesser-included offenses with a strategy of a direct, I'm not guilty of anything?
Well, it is inconsistent with the all-or-nothing strategy, but in lesser-included offense, you're charged with a greater offense, and then the issue is, did you commit the greater offense or the lesser offense? In a level of liability, a greater offense is committed, but the question is, are you culpable for that greater degree? I think it's different, and I don't want to sound forked tongue because the result's still the same. If you win on the lesser included offense, it's still attempted robbery second degree. If you win with the level of liability offense, it's still attempted robbery second degree. But the benefits are the same. But I think he should have been aware of it. He should have advised my client, and it should have been revisited at the end of the trial, and it wasn't. I mean, it just did not pop up on anybody's radar, and I think that's ineffective.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.
Please rise.